You and I are living in a world that is flooded, that is engulfed with darkness. And that darkness is symbolic of sin and superstition and error and wickedness and the like. I believe that God has some lower lights that are burning. One of these, of course, would be the Bible. Another would be His Son and that Son's church. And another light that needs to be burning brightly is that of the Christian home. It's the latter that we talk about in our study today. The home, of course, is a divine institution. It had its marvelous beginning not in the minds of men. It had its beginning in the mind of God. And, of course, He purposed it. He willed it into existence for the betterment of man and for the betterment of woman. What can the church of our Lord do, or what can the Christian home do for the world about us? Well, the church, of course, is obligated to preach the gospel, to help those who are in need, and to edify or keep saved the saved. I believe the Christian home can be a great means of helping our world come to an awareness of what God wants the home to be. And I want to suggest a few things by way of the negative, and then some things by way of the positive. I've learned through the years that this is a good way to approach a Bible topic, to look at it negatively, and then to look at it positively. I believe that the Christian home is in position to give some words of warning to the world about certain dangers that are so disruptive and destructive to marriage and the family. The word devil begins with a D, and I can think of a number of words that likewise begin with a D that become the devices that Satan uses most effectively in order to undermine God's cause in general, and certainly to disrupt and to destroy the home as God intended it to be. Paul reminds us in 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 11 how that we ought not to be ignorant of the devil's devices, and indeed we ought not to be. But apparently many people in the world either ignore or maybe don't even know about some of these dangers. They know about them, but at least they are not willing to give them up. They go ahead and practice them, even though it's going to mean the disruption and the destruction of their home. I think of divorce, and it's been around for a long, long time. Moses, 3,500 years ago, made a concession about divorce in Deuteronomy chapter 24. The Old Testament ends with the book of Malachi, and God sounded forth His attitude toward the putting away or the divorce process, and He said, "I hate it." And God hasn't changed His mind from that day until now, because divorce severs that which He Himself has joined together, one man with one woman for a lifetime. But divorce has been on the increase in our society, and it has become epidemic in recent years. When my late grandparents were born during the decade of the Civil War, 1860s, or the 1860s, the number of divorces in the entire country were only a few thousand. When my late father was born at the turn of the century, the number of divorces were only a few tens of thousands, maybe 50,000 or less. But when he died 70 years later, according to World Almanac for 1971, there were 708,000 divorces. The number of divorces in his lifetime, and he lived the proverbial 70, just about climbed about 13 times as high as it was the day of his birth. And yet the number of new marriages were only about 3 times as high the day of his death as the day of his birth. That says something about marriage and divorce during the 1900s. I think that 1975 will continue to live in infamy. I believe that's the first year that our country reached 1 million divorces. And I've tried to keep up with the statistics every year since. I don't think that we have fallen underneath that 1 million a single year since. A while back, Brother Goble Music wrote a book and entitled it Divorce. He asked me to read the manuscript of it, and I wrote the foreword to it. And he pointed out in that book that at the rate that we're going now, we could well reach 2 million by next century. There may be something that will keep that from happening. Obviously, there's not going to be any divorcing when there hasn't been any marrying. And many couples have decided just to discard marriage, and they have begun to live together. Now, that's been around for a long time, but it hasn't been around to the extent that it is today. It now numbers into the millions of men and women who just decide to live together. And they sometimes say, we don't think a piece of paper is all that important. We don't think something that a preacher or a civil officer might say is all that important. Well, it narrows down to whether they're going to respect the law of God. It narrows down to whether they're going to respect the law of the land. It narrows down to whether they are really willing to make a permanent commitment, the very thing that neither one of them is willing to do. It is now the case, live with him, live with her, until the excitement is gone, and then let there be a parting of the ways and pick out another new, interesting, and maybe a more beautiful woman or a more handsome man with whom to live for a period of time. And that is becoming epidemic in our society. Well, the more that people do that, the less there will be of divorces. But we still register far more than 1 million every single year. And in view of the fact that we only have about 2 million, a little over 2 million new marriages, and over 1 million divorces, that means that every time one couple stands before the marriage altar, another is going to the divorce court, ready to hear the judge pronounce. And a judge somewhere does this, or judges do this, a little over 4,000 times each day, divorce granted. I guess it would be difficult to find two more words of impact and destruction and disruption in our society than divorce granted. But we stand in position to teach the world about the evils of divorce. And then there is another kindred devilish deed. That is desertion, where the man and his wife just simply part and go their separate ways. They don't enter into any kind of divorce proceedings. In fact, this has sometimes been called the poor man's divorce system. But it still means a violation of marital vows. It still means a broken home. It still means handicapped children. It still means the couple are not willing to do what a few months or a few years or maybe several years earlier they had promised to do. Love and honor and cherish each other until death parts the sacred tie that binds. Desertion is another devilish deed. Another is drinking, and that's been around for a long, long time. We see what it did to the home of Noah in the latter part of Genesis, the 9th chapter. Brother Larimore used to say, maybe we ought not to blame Noah too much, because after all, he's the first case on record of anybody that ever got drunk. But Brother Larimore was quick to say, we never read about Noah's getting drunk a second time, and that cannot be said for millions of drinking people today. They get drunk about every weekend. Sometimes they stay drunk more than they stay sober. But look at what it did to Noah's home. Look at what it did to Lot's home in Genesis, the 19th chapter. I think his two daughters must have realized that we'll never carry out our plan to father a child by our or to have a child by our father unless we get him drunk. And that's what they did. And so Lot had children by his two daughters, and these, of course, became the Ammonites and the Moabite people who were constant thorns in the side of God's people in the Old Testament. And so we have drunkenness and drinking as certainly great plagues to today's home. I tried to help some homes stay together where there was the presence of drinking. Some of those homes are not together today. I think they would have been if both husband and wife had said, there's not going to be a drop of liquor allowed in our household. We're going to declare war on it, and we're going to try to rear our children to hate the stuff even as we do. But drinking does great damage to the home. And then other drugs, and I mention it exactly that way because drinking or alcohol is a drug, but we live in a highly drug-like situation. The number of people who are involved in the drug traffic and drug participation continues to increase at such a rapid rate. I began to do some writing way back in the 1960s in regard to the drug situation then. But the statistics that I used back in the 1960s are nowhere accurate as I used them in the 1990s for the simple reason that the drug problem has continued to accelerate in our society. And then I think about some other devilish deeds. Dancing would certainly be of that number. Now, it is begun usually by young people, and they're getting younger and younger with the ages that they now start, elementary and junior high, and people fall in love with that kind of thing, and even when they get married, they don't want to quit their dancing. And usually after the honeymoon period is ended, when the couple goes dancing, he wants to dance with somebody else's wife. She wants to dance with somebody else's husband. And a great many homes are now no longer together because somebody danced his or her way into another person's heart. I think of two homes I tried to save a number of years ago. I worked with both couples. Drinking was involved and dancing was involved. In one of the cases, the young wife had danced her way into the life and heart of somebody else's husband. And she helped to destroy that home. Hers stayed together, but the other home was destroyed. I had an opportunity to talk to a member of that family, of the home that was destroyed, some time back. I asked, is there a single member of that household who is now faithful to the church? He said, not a single one. The husband is not. The wife, and she died a while back, is not. And they reared three or four daughters, and he said not a single one of the daughters is now faithful to the church. Maybe if there had not been the presence of dancing and drinking, that home might have stayed together, and there might have been souls on the way to heaven today that are on the way to hell simply because the mother and father would not say no to the sensual inducement or seducement. And then I think of another devilish deed. That would be disinterest, where the husband loses any interest in wife and children, or the woman loses interest in her husband and her children. This actually occurred in a Tennessee courtroom a number of years back. It involved a man, his wife, and four little precious children. And the judge who wrote about it said that the woman had become unfaithful. The man in the courtroom pleaded with his wife, let's straighten out our problem. Let's keep our home together. And the judge said that the woman with a wave of the hand said, no, I want my freedom. I don't want you, and I don't want these children. She had become disinterested in her role as wife, her role as mother. And the number is legion of people who fall into that same category. And sometimes there is disinterest between parent and child. The child loses an interest in the parent, or the parent loses an interest in the child, and it adds up to a great deal of heartache. I think of disobedience, and that, of course, will crumble any foundation within the home. Where there is disobedience to God, where there is disobedience to the kind of authority that I spoke about last night, the authority that God has placed in the family framework. Disobedience is certainly a devilish deed. I think of deviation, and by that I refer to homosexuality, lesbianism, and these are having a disastrous effect not only upon the world, but at times they invade the church. I think of a couple who visited in our home some years back. At that time, he was a faithful gospel preacher, and his wife seemed to be dedicated. They had some lovely children. During the visit, his wife told my wife, "I'm proud of my husband who preaches. I want him to stay sound. I want to do everything that I can to help him in his work as a gospel preacher." I don't know whether she was practicing her lesbianism at that time or not, but it wasn't long after that visit until we received the tragic news that she had said to her husband and to the children, "I no longer want any part of any of you." She had fallen in love with another woman and preferred her lesbian lover to her husband and her children, and of course the God that she had been taught about from childhood on up. Deviation is certainly a curse upon the home and in our society. I believe those of us who form Christian homes and have an opportunity to talk to other people, that we can help to educate the world about us in regard to these devilish deeds. And certainly we can provide even a greater impact in saying, we're not going to be part and parcel of these evils. We're going to try to be the answer to these problems and not become a part of the problem itself. And then on the positive side for the remainder of our lesson today, I believe that the Christian home can teach the world that God's way is best for the home. We certainly need to stress that there needs to be preparation in going into marriage. And I believe Brother Mike Watt will be dealing with that in a later lecture. I wrote a little tract a number of years ago asking the question, what will you bring to the marriage altar? And I mentioned such things as, you need to bring maturity of mind. You need to bring purity of person. You need to bring a permanency of purpose. You need to bring the spirit of submission, the spirit of selfless service. You need to bring the tone of trust. You need to bring the loyalty of love. These were some of the things that I mentioned in proper preparation for marriage. I believe that the Christian home can stress, I believe we can and we must, can stress to the world about us in regard to the beautiful basics of marriage. Marriage is not a human institution begun by man and woman, begun as an experiment to see if it would be workable for the two of them. Marriage, somewhat like the church, is a divine human institution. In the church, we have the divine element. In the church, we have the human element. In marriage, we have the divine and the human. Marriage is composed of two human beings, a man and a woman. But remember, God is also in the process. That's why we emphasize in our marriage ceremonies the prominent place that God is to play within the developing marriage and the continuing home situation. Well, we certainly need to teach the world around us that marriage is divine in its origin. We read in the closing part of Genesis 2 how that God looked upon the loneliness of man that he had just created. And by the way, man was made on the sixth day and woman was made on the sixth day. I think some people have the idea that woman was made way down the line, days or even months later. Remember, God ceased his work of creation at the end of day six, but woman is a part of that creation. Therefore, she was created before he finished or ceased his work of creation. Adam made earlier that day, Eve made later that day, but they were both made on day number six. But after Adam had been made, God surveyed his heart and his life and concluded it's not good for the man to be by himself. He said, "I'll make for man a helpmate." And that's not helpmate and push together. It's two words, help and then meet, meaning I'm going to make someone suitable for the man. I'm going to make that which will complete the man. I'm going to make that which will be a helper, a companion to him. And that's how Eve came about to be. God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam. From his side he removed rib, ribs, flesh, and built a woman. Upon seeing the glorious creature at his side, Adam was led to say, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." Many of us, especially in marriage ceremonies, have pointed out to the couples before us in these ceremonies that you will observe that when God chose a bone, he did not choose it from man's foot. He did not intend the wife to be a doormat. He did not choose a bone from man's head. He did not intend for the woman to be man's dictator. But he chose a bone from man's side, symbolic of the fact that here was a creature worthy to walk by his side. Not several paces behind as inferior, not several paces ahead as superior, but by his side as his co-equal. And then from underneath his arm, throughout the Bible, arm is symbolic of power and might and the means of protection. And certainly the wife is to be protected and shielded by the husband who claims her hand in marriage, puts a ring upon her finger, and changes her maiden name to that of his. So she is eminently worthy of being his constant object of protection. And then from near his heart, literally near his physical heart, and of course, the woman becomes, in a real sense, the heartbeat of the marriage. That's the beautiful and remarkable origin of marriage. Now, unbelieving sociologists have told us through the years, we cannot even know how marriage came about to be. I remember Brother Dixon, H.A. Dixon, longtime president of Freed Hardeman, giving a lecture a number of years ago dealing with the home, and he referred to this, and he said in his own eloquent way that those of us who accept the Bible can say, by faith, we know how marriage came about to be, and indeed, we do. I believe that as the Christian home, we can stress to the world about us that marriage is to be permanent in its nature. Not an average of 7 years. I think Brother Perry mentioned that figure in his speech, and I'd come across that sometime back also. The average life of marriage in the country that you and I live in today is about 7 years. If I may coin a word, we are now having marital shortjevity instead of having marital longevity. Marriages are getting shorter and shorter. I clipped a little piece from our paper in Memphis some years back, and whoever did the writing of it suggested that marriages in Tennessee are becoming shorter and shorter and shorter. I already knew that, but this man was not connected with the Lord's church, for as I know, was not writing from a religious background, but he recognized that marriages are in trouble in Tennessee. And Tennessee happens to be in what is sometimes called the Bible Belt. And yet many people are not willing to accept the Bible and let it be their guide in marital matters. So we need to stress that marriage is permanent. God's ideal has been, is, and will continue to be one man for one woman for one man for a lifetime. And that is to be the ideal. And I know that Jesus recognized the place that fornication can come in and play, and allowing the innocent party to put away the guilty party and then enter into another acceptable marriage. But that's not God's ideal. Even when that occurs, it means that one has sinned and sinned grievously. I often refer to this as being the crimson crime of matrimony, because it's the one thing that Jesus recognized as grounds for putting away one's unfaithful mate. But God means for marriage to be permanent. That's what I was taught by my Christian parents. That's what my wife and I have tried to teach our children. That's what I've taught from pulpits throughout this country, wherever I've had an opportunity to speak. And that's what you're preaching, and that's what you're teaching. And I believe that's a great contribution that the Christian home can make to the world around us. Teach those around us that marriage is for life. I believe that the Christian home can and must stress that marriage is to be mutual in its obligations. There are responsibilities that the husband sustains from the time that he says, "I do," until death. There are responsibilities and obligations that the wife sustains until that marriage ends with the death of one of the two. I have usually, in every ceremony that I've ever pronounced, incorporated a number of things from Ephesians, the 5th chapter. It's one of the most needed passages in the entire Bible. And it's always struck me with a great deal of significance that Paul talked about marriage before he talked about parenthood. He talks about marriage in Ephesians 5, and then he talks about fathers and children in chapter 6, simply meaning that marriage is to be first, and then after that, the intimacy within that marriage, and then the bearing of children later on. That's the order in which Paul injects it, 1 Timothy 5:14. "I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully." And so we need to emphasize the responsibilities, the obligations. And Paul does a superb job in outlining those for the husband, in outlining those for the wife in Ephesians, the 5th chapter. Now he does so, Peter does so in 1 Peter 3, but there are other passages that do this, but certainly Paul does it in Ephesians, the 5th chapter. And usually in a ceremony, after I've referred to these principles in Ephesians 5, I will look the couple right in the eye and say, "That is my firm conviction that if the two of you will subscribe to these principles, that your marriage can always rest upon the firm foundation of God's abiding word." Unfortunately, some of the couples that I've said that to haven't paid much attention to that, and they've dissolved their marriages. Some of them are now in second, third, and fourth marriages, and that is a tragedy indeed. I talk quite often with young couples in their early 20s, and maybe the man's already in his third marriage, maybe the wife's already in her second marriage, maybe they've had children by every marital maid. Somehow they think that I can just wave a magic wand and all of their troubles and complexities will just automatically evaporate. And it doesn't work that way. I will always appreciate a young lady who came to me some years back. She had begun to date a divorcee, which I thought was a most dangerous practice because his divorce was very, very questionable. And she asked me what she ought to do. Well, she and I turned and read passage after passage from the Bible. And when we finished, she said, "I knew that's exactly what you would tell me, that I ought not to be dating this man." Well, soon she ceased, and then she began to date a young man that was eligible for marriage, and I had the opportunity of performing their marriage, and they now have a little darling boy to bless their union. But how much better it was that she came before she got into that entangling alliance than after getting into it, then coming and saying, "What now can I do?" A wise elder in a Michigan church told me many years ago, he said, "Preacher, it's a lot easier to stay out of these entangling alliances than it is to get out of them when you're once in them." Well, we need to tell the world about the responsibilities of husband and wife and that it's a lifetime proposition. I believe that we in Christian homes can stress to the world that it is in marriage and no other place where sexual intimacy can be experienced. Brother Warren has referred to this as the extra language spoken by the husband and the wife. And they're the only two that can really speak that language, that can really engage with God's approval in acts like this. And yet the world at large ignores this. Dating has become a period in which fornication flourishes. And there's not really a great deal to look forward to on the honeymoon night. A wise preacher once made the statement to a group of young people. He said, you are going to face one or two things on your first night together. You will either say, we're glad we waited until the time was right, or we wish we had waited until the time was right. Many people have not decided on the wisdom of waiting until it is right in the sight of God. We need to try in every way that we can to get that message across to our children, our young people, and as many people as we can in the world about us. I believe that we in Christian homes can stress that in marriage there is a threesome and not a twosome. Too many people have the idea that marriage is like a straight line, husband here, wife here, that it is simply a human contract. And if he wants to break it and she wants to break it, either one or both of them together have the right so to do. But much more accurate is the observation that marriage is something like a triangle. And I'm not referring to the man having a side interest or the woman having a side interest. I'm referring to God being at the top angle and the husband and wife at the base angles. That means each one has a hold upon the other and each one has a hold upon God. Remember, in the first marriage, it is God, Adam, and Eve, not just Adam and Eve. Remember in the beautiful account of our Lord's initial miracle, John the 2nd chapter, it is the Lord present at that marriage feast, and then the unnamed groom and bride. Really, it is a threesome and not a twosome. I think we need to get that message to as many people in the world as we possibly can. And we certainly need to stress to the world that marriage is to be heterosexual and not homosexual. There was a little clipping that appeared in our paper some time back where two university students up at the University of Minnesota, male students, had obtained a marriage license, had persuaded a Methodist minister to say a ceremony over them, spoke to the media about going on a honeymoon and talked about the happiness they expected to find in their homosexual marriage. Well, that's coming. It's coming a lot closer and a lot quicker than many of us wish that it did. We wish that it would never come. But I took that little clipping and wrote an article for one of our papers, and I called it A Brideless Marriage, because no bride was present. And I projected that sooner or later we'll begin to hear about groomless marriages, where no groom will be present, just two women or just two men. I guess we've all, as preachers, preached on the text in Genesis chapter 13 about Lot pitching his tent towards Sodom. But really, Sodom's about the only place that anybody's tent can be pitched now. It's all around us. And about the only shield we have against Sodom is to try to keep it out of our hearts and lives and out of our homes and out of the lives of our children. But we need to stress to the world about us that when God began marriage, He began with a man, not two men. He began with a woman, not two women. He began with a man and a woman. And they constitute marriage as God would have it to be. The Christian home, I believe, can stress to the society about us as no other home can, that marriage in God's way is absolutely not only the best way, but the only way. Thank you for having me and for your great attention.